So, morning everyone. It's week two of this mini series that we're doing now on resilience. Next week is the last one of this term, after which we'll take a break for a few weeks and then come back term three with something new. 1 week to go for the raffle. Thank you to all those who have participated, and here we go, one more week, so spread the word. Just to quickly review what we did last week, I'm happy to see the Zoom is working this week. As I said before to some people, actually it was a worldwide outage. Yeah, it wasn't just me. It wasn't my technology limitation. It was actually a Zoom outage, which happened to happen just while we were doing the Thursday morning thing. Anyway, so last week we talked about resilience. We talked about that there's two parts of resilience. One is the foundations of resilience, and also the tools. So the foundation, we talked about two, the concept of the analogy of a person being compared to a tree, and the tree that we see is the functionality, the consciousness of the person, but the roots are the what lives deeper, and that's the concept of emunah, the concept of faith. Faith is an important foundation for resilience. And the second was the idea of purpose and meaning. So when we have purpose and meaning, we're much more inspired and motivated and driven to bounce back, because to give the pain some sort of meaning and channel it. If it's random, if life is just random, then we become crushed, it becomes a failure. But if we have meaning and purpose, there's a reason to try and channel the pain into something more purposeful and meaningful. And last week, in terms of tools, we drew some inspiration from an article by a guy called Kenneth Ginsberg, who talked about the seven C's of resilience. We'll just quickly run through them. The first was confidence, really believing that we can do it. The second is competence, that we have it within ourselves. We need to connect to ourselves a little bit and understand our inner message and our inner workings of strength and conviction and so on. Connection at the same time. We can't do it all ourselves. We have to be connected to other people. Character, which was the idea of focusing inwards, that the concept of focusing on values. Contribution, remembering that we always have to bounce back because we all have a unique contribution to make that's different to everyone else. Coping, which is the idea of the ability to think long-term and make decisions and plan ahead and so on, as opposed to short-term pleasure. And the last one was control, remembering that at the end of the day, resilience is a choice. But the good news is that resilience can be learnt, right? That was the concept. Okay. So today, I want to focus on a specific area of resilience. What I mean by that is like this, because resilience really has two parts to it. Can need to happen in two ways, right? The first way is what we normally talk about resilience, where we're bouncing back from a pain or a challenge that was externally imposed. So for example, a person loses a job, a person loses a loved one, God forbid, a person, any other external sort of stress, right, that happens not by choice or by our doing, but by something that's happening from the outside. So yes, we believe and it's all a plan and it's all important and everything has a purpose, so we try and bounce back. But then there's a different kind of resilience, which is bouncing back and being resilient from our own internal pain, meaning our own internally imposed challenge, which is specifically, I'm talking about the concept of bouncing back from our own failings, our own mistakes, right? Which is hard sometimes. We often make our own mistakes. We mess up, make bad choices. And then we have to bounce back from them rather than beating ourselves up, right? In other words, the concept of bouncing back from failure and making mistakes is really the concept of learning, because we all make mistakes, right? None of us are perfect, but so it's really learning how to fail. It's knowing how to fail well, right? Which is not easy, because as I said, failure is part of every human experience, right? It's the choices we make and the mistakes we make and so on. But at the end of the day, we choose, after we made the mistake, after we failed, we choose if it's going to become a cause for total brokenness and further failure, and it'll become a spiral and a cycle of failure, or is the failure that we engage in going to become a catalyst for greatness, which it can be if we choose so, and if we're resilient, right? I saw a little article written by a guy called Zvi Freeman, who is a Oh, really? Oh, okay, well, there you are. So let me read it out to you. It's beautiful. He writes very beautifully, and he has these lots of articles on the website, Chabad.org, where he bases his concepts on teachings from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but he puts them in a very sort of his own words and his own packaging, so to speak. So he writes, it's not a long thing, I'll just read it to you. He says, the only one thing that can put you further ahead than success is surviving failure. Right, which is very beautiful. And he explains why. He says, when you're successful, you are whole and complete. That is wonderful. But you cannot break out beyond your own universe because you're complete, right? So you're covered by this completeness. When you fail, you are broken. You look at the pieces of yourself lying on the ground and say, this is worthless. But now you can escape. The shell is broken. The defining shell of a created being. Now there are no limits to how tall you can grow. Which is a very nice way of explaining how failure can actually be a catalyst of greatness and growth. Now, I'm going to draw an article today as well, but much before we do that, from a Jewish perspective, the concept of bouncing back from mistakes, spiritually, not just practically, but spiritually, is very powerful. And it goes to the heart of a concept which we've often talked about, which is the idea of tshuva, repentance or return, or repairing a negative past, right? Which we are taught that the concept of tshuva, in terms of our relationship with God, right? So tshuva is particularly when we mess up either between us and other people or between us and God, or both together, and we can reconnect, right? And we are taught that tshuva creates a very, very powerful and deep, or deeper, relationship with God, right? Why? Because the way it works, it's a similar concept to what we said before in the article. So the way it works is like this, right? God created the world with a system. He gave us a moral code. He gave us a moral system. When we break that system, so it's broken. Now, how do we go forward? So, although on the surface, when we don't do what we're supposed to, we just break the system and the system doesn't work. However, God gives us that ability to do tshuva. He gives us the ability to come back. But the depth of tshuva, which is really true with all failure in a way, is that it doesn't only fix the future. And I think this is a very important thing to bear in mind. We'll come back to it towards the end. Right? Because spiritually, because when you were supposed to accomplish something last week and you didn't, right? Okay, so you bounce back. You say, okay, you know what? From tomorrow, I'm going to behave. From tomorrow, I'm going to do better. I'm going to improve. I'm going to, whatever the case is, right? I'm going to be more effective, more productive, more spiritual, more perfect, whatever the case is. Not perfect, never perfect, but towards, right? More aspirational. Then that fixes the future, but doesn't fix the past. But we are taught in Kabbalah that tshuva is different, actually. Because what tshuva does, it's not that we work the system from now on. We've broken the system. And therefore what tshuva does, it opens up a whole new system for us, a deeper system, a transcendent system. And spiritually speaking, we are taught that tshuva sort of deepens the relationship between us and God to such a level, it doesn't just change the future, it changes the past. And we fix even those things which we didn't do in the past, if we do tshuva properly, right? So, because it releases this powerful energy that's able to not only do well from now on, but able actually to complete and to fill in what was missing even from the past. So that's on a very esoteric spiritual level, but the truth is, even on a practical level, if we understand what it is to bounce back from failure properly, we can understand how we can even turn around the past. The mistake is still there, maybe the pain will still be there, but the past becomes part of the future, and we'll talk about how that works. So how do we do that practically? So there's an article, a beautiful article in that booklet that I showed you last week from Dr. Pelkowitz, and we'll draw particularly on his article and a couple of other things as well. And the article is called Growing from Setbacks. Right? And he starts off the article with an interesting study that was done, and he said a recent national study of physicians who made serious errors, which everyone's human, physicians too, they can make errors, with their patients, found that those who were open to learning from their mistakes became better physicians and better individuals as a result of this painful process, right? So that's an obvious thing. So if you're willing to learn from your mistakes, you become better at what you're doing. So there already we have this concept But obviously failure is a catalyst for growth, because failure is an opportunity to learn from a mistake and how to become better in the future. So how does it all work? So he discusses three ideas, and I want to just sort of go through them and unpack them idea. The first is the concept which is the most simple but the most difficult and painful, and that is to accept responsibility, right? To know that when we make a mistake, no one's going to do it for us. It's no one's fault, at least as far as we're concerned, and no one is going to fix our mistake. It's us. We need to own it, and we need to take responsibility. You know, I often share with you things from the Kotzker Rebbe, who was very sharp, right? So they tell a little story about one of the disciples of the Kotzker Rebbe who traveled quite a while, and he came to in front of the Kotzker Rebbe distraught, and he was really upset. And he started to cry, and he said, "Rebbe, I sinned. You've no idea, Rebbe," he said, "the worst sins I've done. How do I do tshuva? I've gone to many rabbis, no one can help me. How do I do it? Help me, guide me." So in his very quick and sharp and witty way, the Kotzker Rebbe turned to him and said, "Let me ask you a question," he says. "Before you sinned, did you also ask people advice how to sin?" So the guy was taken aback. He says, "No, I didn't. I just sinned, right?" He says, "Well, then just do tshuva. Just the same way as you sinned." Now, obviously, you need guidance, and obviously we need other people. But what he was trying to say is, the first thing you need to do is, no one's going to show you how to, we can help you, we can guide you, we can inspire you, we can, you know, give you direction. But at the end of the day, this is your journey, right? You sinned, you do tshuva. You fix it. It's got to come from you. At the end of the day, you've got to own the process. You've got to own the failure, and you've got to own the process. Just as failure, in other words, you're saying, just as failure wasn't scripted for you. You chose to make that mistake. Maybe inadvertently, maybe intentionally, whatever the case is, but it came from you, your tshuva has to come from you as well. So therefore, Dr. Berkowitz says that the first step in adapting and engaging and dealing with setbacks is what he calls the maturity to accept responsibility for one's role in the mistake, right? Now, what we tend to do often is we tend to externalize, right? So we tend to blame other people. It's this one's fault, it's this thing's fault, it's, you know, right? Why do we actually do that? It's interesting, why do we do that? Why are we so quick to do that? So a number of reasons. First of all, it provides temporary comfort. If I made a bad mistake, oh, it was someone else's fault. He forgot to tell me. He didn't send me the memo. He didn't show me how to do it. Whatever the case was, right? It's just comforting to know that, oh, it wasn't me. The problem is like this, and he gives a beautiful analogy. He said it's like comparable to a child falling and skinning the knee, right? So what would provide the most immediate comfort, he said, would just be to put a Band-Aid on it, right? But that's not what people do. What do people do? You have to first apply antiseptic and clean the wound. But everyone knows that's very painful, right? So temporary comfort is good in the short term, but long term it's troublesome because it's not a wise thing to do. You run the risk of reinfection and of a longer healing process, and so on and so forth, and it's not very effective. The effective and wiser way to do it is to go through the pain of wiping the wound, right? So it's the same thing. When we make a mistake, the temporary Band-Aid that provides short-term relief is externalization and blaming something or someone else, right? But it's least pain, but it's the least wise. Because then we don't grow, we don't learn, and we don't improve. So the first thing is we need to accept our responsibility in the mistake, our role in the mistake. A very hard thing to do. And then work from there, right? Now, the truth is, not just make mistakes. This is the basis of all forms of growth, right? We've talked about this many times. All forms of growth is that we need to know that our weaknesses are our journey. It's our story, and we have to own that story, the good and the bad. Right, what we do is our story, which we need to own and we need to work with. Now, we've talked about many times, the obvious way to do this is to internalize the idea that our failings don't define us, but they are ours. It's very different. They don't define us, but they belong to us, right? And that's so important. I know we talk about this many times, but it's worth just re-emphasizing it. And in fact, the one thing is dependent on the other. The reason that it's easier to own it is because it doesn't define us. So the analogy we always give is like a garment. The garment's not me, but it's mine. It's very different. Very different between being me or mine. So it's not me, which is good news because it's easier to take responsibility for it then, because if it's me, I don't like to take responsibility for it because I don't want to be defined as a failure. But at the same time, because it doesn't define me, it makes it easy for me, and I must realize and I must take responsibility and say it's not me, but it's mine. And I need to own it. No one else can own it. And also because it's not me, it gives me the ability to work with it. And to change it and to improve it. Right? I think a long time ago we mentioned this as the basis of everything. I mean, in Tanakh, in the book of the Torah, we find this idea of the difference between Adam and King David, right? Adam was a very, very holy person. Adam was designed by God himself. He's called in the Talmud, Yitzir Kapav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's the handiwork of God. And yet, Adam sinned with the fruit, and God confronted him. And the very, very first response to failure we find in the Torah is, it wasn't my fault. That's it. Adam, the great Adam, blamed it on his wife. His wife blamed it on the snake. By the time he got to the snake, there's no one else to blame. Right? But that's the story. That's the very, very first human failing. Is not. There were two things, by the way. There were two things, and it's an amazing thing that we find in the Torah, in Genesis, that the first cause of human failing, the first response to human failing, is the lack of self-control, right? Which is the foundation of all growth, which was Adam and Eve couldn't hold themselves back for 3 hours not to eat the fruit that they were told not to eat. And then the second mistake, which was also foundational, was not taking responsibility, right? Whereas King David, and this is the famous story of King David. Now, the story of King David is very complex. Him and Bathsheba, it's not exactly the way it sounds. The Talmud and the Kabbalah goes into great detail about, obviously, if you just read the words literally, it sounds like he was a terrible person. But obviously, King David wasn't. There was a lot of spiritual stuff that was going on there. But at the end of the day, on his level, King David made a mistake. He sinned, right? He was halachically permitted to her, and all the, as the Talmud explains, and all that, etc., etc., but he made a mistake. And yet, King David is always praised by God, remains close to God, remains God's faithful servant. Why? Because when Natan Hanavi, the prophet, came to David and confronted him and said to him, gave him an analogy, and he said, why did you do this? As soon as King David was confronted, his first word he said to the prophet was, Chatati, I have sinned. I made a mistake. I take full responsibility for it. And now let me begin the process of tshuva. And that's it. That's all God wanted. Human beings are meant to fail. We are designed to fail. For all sorts of reasons, including one we're going to talk about. But God doesn't mind so much. I mean, obviously, we shouldn't intend to fail. We're not supposed to intend to make mistakes. Right? That's not the process, a healthy process of a human being. We don't go into anything, whether it's practical or spiritual, we don't go into anything intending to fail or intending to make a mistake. But when we do, all God wants us is to say, it's mine. It's my mistake. I'm not defined by the mistake, but it is mine, and I'm going to work with it. That's all. Take responsibility. I want to share with you something I came across, a very beautiful explanation. I've mentioned this story before, but not with this detail. Because it's really fundamental in everything, and I think it's particularly relevant in the generation that we find ourselves in, for reasons you'll see in a moment. So, the Talmud tells us about a person who was known as Rebbe Lazar ben Durdaya. That was his name. His father's name was Durdaya, and his name was Elazar. But he wasn't actually a sage of the Talmud. He was a well-known sinner, a big lowlife, a very, very terrible person. a very, very immoral person who had temptation for all sorts of failings, including sexual immorality. And the story in the Talmud goes that one day he was visiting a particular person in a brothel and so on. And in the middle, the prostitute said to him something, you know, you're a really low-life guy. Like, you're not exactly very... And I think that you have no salvation. You probably won't even make it to the world to come. That's what she said to him. Something about the way she said it, something triggered something in him and it struck a chord. And it shook him up and he really walked out and he thought, you know, Tucker, my life's in a big mess. And I really need to reconnect. So he was full of shame and remorse and he went and he fled to the mountains. That's what the Talmud says. So he was driven by this unbelievable desire to return to God and God's path and so on, if God would forgive him, right? So the story goes as follows. The story goes, he cried out to the mountains, whatever the story means in its imagery, but this is the imagery the Talmud describes. He called out to the mountains and the hills and he said, please, would you please plead my case for me before God? Ask God to have mercy on me. The mountains and the hills responded, no, we must plead for ourselves and we're not going to do it. So he turned towards the heaven and he said, please, heavens and earth, intercede on my behalf. And they said, no. Sun and moon, he wailed, please beg for mercy for my soul. Also not. And last thing he did was he gazed at the sky and he looked at the stars and he says, please, stars and mazalot, which is planets and constellations, would you please plead my case for me? And he received the same response. So the Talmud goes on and says he fell to the ground, his head in his hands, and he cried from the depths of his soul. Right? And he said these words. He said, well, if that's the case, Ein hadavar talui elabi. If that's the case, this whole thing depends solely on me. And he's cried and he cried. Now, this is not the ending every repentant is supposed to have, but in his case, what happened was he cried actually until his soul left his body in absolute repentance and remorse. And the Talmud says that a heavenly voice went out at that moment and said, Rabbi Lazar ben Dudaya, welcome, your repentance has been accepted and you're worthy to come into the world to come. So the commentaries ask the question, they say, what was this, the imagery about the mountains and the hills and the stars? Or what is all that? So one explanation goes like this, a very beautiful idea. Mountains and hills represent father and mother. We know this from another part of the Tanakh where Bilam, the prophet Bilam, he said when he was going to curse the Jewish people, he said, I can't curse them because I look at them from the hills, from the mountains and the hills. And the commentary explained what he was really talking about was our patriarchs and our matriarchs, mountains and hills. Also interesting, in Hebrew, the word for mountains is harim, which is very similar to the word horim, which is parents, right? So when he was asking the mountains and the hills to intervene, what he was really thinking, he said, you know, maybe it's my parents' fault that I turned out this way, right? He was blaming a little bit subtly. You know, they didn't discipline me enough, they didn't have the time to invest in me, they didn't give me the proper moral education. Now, there's no question that parents have an amazing influence, right? And the parents shouldn't think, well, I shouldn't be blamed and it's up to the kid. But no, a parent should take responsibility. But that plea was rejected, right? So he tries a different defense. He's defending himself in the first part of the thing. And he turns to heaven and earth, which are symbols of society. And he thinks to himself, you know, it was just the environment I grew up. It was the environment. It was a bad environment. I had bad friends, bad influences, and so on and so forth. Everyone was doing what I was doing. Everyone was persuading me. Everyone was influencing me. So it's a little bit, it wasn't my, you know, yes, my choice, but it wasn't my fault. God should forgive me on that behalf. He's saying, you know, intercede on my behalf. Use that as a defense. And it wasn't answered. So he tries again. Sun and moon, which the commentary say, Rashi apparently says the sun and moon is a symbol of brightness, a symbol of affluence. He says, you know, I was spoiled, says the Quran. I was spoiled. I grew up too wealthy, you know. There was too much of an emphasis on the material world in my home. And I just couldn't escape it. It wasn't my fault. I got lured into it. And that was the defense. And nothing happened. By the way, if you think this is far-fetched, I watched a video once, not that long, a few years ago in America, just after interceding with this, I have to just interject with this because it's actually amazing. I watched a video once. There was a program, and they have it all over the world, but in New York it was popular for a little bit in parts of the religious community. It was called Mic Drop. And the Mic Drop program at that time was sort of like, I guess, attached to the concept of vulnerability, I think very badly applied, but nevertheless it sort of was, right? And it was these people who went through very traumatic experiences, and part of the healing was this Mic Drop, where they would get up in front of, I don't know how many people, or social media, or thousands of people for that matter, and tell this story and tell them how broken they were and so on and so forth, and then kind of affirm that they're getting through it, that they're going to be stronger, and that would sort of help them. I don't think it's a very effective process at all. But nevertheless, I think, again, vulnerability is when you seek support from other people. And you know, you seek from individual. We spoke about the first lesson of vulnerability. Where we talked about, like, vulnerability has to be healthy, not on Facebook and not in public, and also you don't heal just by saying I'm okay now. Anyway, but there was some very very sad stories there, and stories of great trauma. And then there was one woman who got up. I couldn't believe this, and her trauma was that she was spoiled as a kid. I thought, are you serious? Like, you know, I was spoiled, I was given too many choices, my parents had too much money. I thought to myself, like, just get over it. Like, that's not trauma, come on. But anyway, apparently Elazar ben Dodaiah used that as a defense as well, right? He said, sun and moon, that's my defense. I grew up to have that. Anyway, that didn't work. So the last attempt he makes is he turns to the stars. What's the stars? He turns to the cosmos. He blames the cosmos. What does it mean? Now, there's a real thing in a way, as we've mentioned many times. The Talmud says that people are influenced by the stars. We do. We have an astrological sign, which even in Judaism is a real thing. Right? The star under which you, the planet under which influence you are born, the day you're born in, the week you're born in, the month you're born, all these things are actually make a difference. There's a whole section on Tractate of Shabbat. It's a very, very fascinating one, right? So he turns to me and says, it must just be my personality. It's my genes, right? If it's not nurture, it must be nature. So he blames the cosmos. He turns to the stars. He says, stars, help me. Come to my defense. It was your fault. And nothing happens. And there's no response. And there's no forgiveness. And there's no tshuva. Oh, until he realizes, this is nothing of this is going to work. Ein hadavar talui elabi. It's just dependent on me. It's my story. I've got to own it. That's it. I've got to own it. Now, does that mean his parents didn't have an influence in him? No. They might have done. They might have had. Parents have an influence. Cosmos has an influence. Environment has an influence. Parenting, everything has an influence. All true. Which is very important to understand, because it's important to understand how we respond to other people, how we influence other people, and the environments that we set up for other people. It's also relevant to our own story, because we need to, going forward, set ourselves up for success, which might mean trying to put ourselves in environments which are more supportive and are easier. But at the end of the day, we don't blame anything else. At the end of the day, we have bechira, we have free choice, and free choice is our story. And the belief that God has and the Torah has in resilience and repairing, how it's never too late, and how you can overcome almost everything, right? Unless a person has a real mental health issue, okay? That's different, because that's an illness. But according to the Torah, and in a court of Jewish law, in the old times, in Mishnaic times, Talmudic times, there was never defenses used for, you know, I really had a homeless childhood, and that's why I became like that, and therefore my sentence for murder should be a little bit less. Nothing. Judaism doesn't recognize it at all. It recognizes the influence, but doesn't recognize it as a means to take away responsibility. Right? So that's the first thing they mentioned in the article. The first thing about bouncing back from a mistake and from a failure is to own it, take responsibility for it. Now, what that means is that it's important to understand, right? It doesn't mean a negative thing that we beat ourselves up, that we're always responsible for everything, right? Because in other words, when we make a mistake, it doesn't mean that we are solely responsible for the mistake. We live in a society, we're collective people. It is very possible that when I mess up and I make a bad mistake, there were other people that made mistakes along the way, and maybe they have a part to play in the mistake. But that's irrelevant. It doesn't help me. It's not going to help me knowing that I made a mistake and I was one of 50 people that made a mistake. Right? Because it's not going to make me a better person. It's not going to allow me to bounce back. It's not going to, it might be a temporary comfort, but it's not going to allow me to really learn from that mistake and grow from that mistake. So, and that's a very, very important thing too in today's society, because, you know, two things can be true at the same time. Which today, by the way, people have a very hard time. I don't know why, but people have a very, very hard time coming to terms with that. There's I don't know, I find that today there's like the concept of nuance is like disappearing from the earth for some reason, right? So everything must be black and white. It's either your fault, it's either my fault, it's either wrong, it's either right. Like there's no nuance, you know? There's no like, this is a perspective and this is a perspective and that can coexist, right? So with mistakes, it happens the same thing. It could be that you have a role to play and that's your business. But also at the same time, it is my responsibility for my growth. Is there a problem with the car? Sorry. Right, so in other words, at the same time, I have to own the part that I own. And again, getting back to the whole, as I said, this is such an important thing because today people, there is, and we've talked about this many, many times, but I'm very passionate about it because I see it happening all over. There is like a victim mentality. We blame trauma. And trauma is a real thing, by the way. Real trauma needs healing. But we can't just slip into trauma and say, I am the way I am because of traumatic experience happening in my life. We have to own it and we have to grow from it. Right? And if there's other people involved, other people have to take responsibility, that's okay. But I have to own my part of the story. Now, it's a hard thing to do. And in this section, Dr. Pelkowitz goes on with a very, very important part. And he says, part of the acceptance and taking responsibility for our own mistake is having the courage and the humility, right, to actually get support from other people. That's where healthy vulnerability comes in, right? In other words, because often without the help of others, we can't really process our own mistakes. We can't really take responsibility properly. So the willingness to take responsibility is on us. But the way it works, because people, as the Talmud says, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo, a person is related to themselves, right? And we're biased, we're subjective, and it's very hard to be fully objective. Once we have a real willingness to take responsibility, then we can enlist the help of others, which is takes courage. It takes courage to go to a loved one or a good friend and say, look, I think I messed up, but I need your help in processing it properly. Why is that so important to help? Because if we leave it to ourselves to process properly, we often process it incorrectly on either side. Either we just deny, we say we're going to take responsibility, but we don't really take responsibility, we don't really recognize our mistakes, or we recognize them too much and we beat ourselves up. And it's all my fault, which not necessarily is true. So we need someone who's a real friend or someone who's a loved one or someone who's objective who can help us. And it's hard to enlist that. It's hard. So the willingness to take responsibility has to come from us. But the process of taking responsibility needs help from others to work through what is my role in this and how do I fix it and what is actually the mistake that I made and what is the failure so that I can take responsibility for my failing, not for someone else's failing, but for my failing. Right? And that's why that courage to actually enlist the help of someone else is really important. So that's the first thing. So the first thing must be this concept of taking responsibility. That's the first foundation to bouncing back from a mistake. It's painful, but long term it's much more effective. It's like putting the antiseptic on the skin knee, which is painful but creates a process of healing. The second thing he says is actively dealing with the situation. Okay, so I take responsibility, now what I do, right? So he says an amazing thing. The first is, because when we make a mistake, often it's not just our mistake, and it doesn't just affect us, but it affects others, right? So he's going back to the study that was done with the doctors, the physicians that made mistakes, right? So he talks about people who avoid apologizing. Part of taking responsibility is apologizing, and apologizing is hard. So what do? We avoid apologizing. We avoid apologizing because we think then it'll go away, just easier. It doesn't actually. A lot of times it just creates a sense of guilt or anxiety and uneasiness and lingers, right? What we do know is that apologizing and saying I'm sorry, as difficult as it is and courageous as it needs to be to do it, it actually begins the process of growth. Because that's the real solidifying of taking responsibility, number one. So for the person making the mistake, it solidifies that responsibility, it solidifies the owning of it. I apologize means I'm verbalizing that it's mine. I apologize for it, which means I'm going to take responsibility for it and I'm going to do something about it, right? But the interesting thing is it's also very, very helpful to the person who I apologize to, because it creates a much, much healthier space for the process of forgiveness. And forgiveness is, as we've talked, we did a whole series once on forgiveness, forgiveness is very powerful, both for the perpetrator and for the victim. Right, both for the person making the mistake and both for the person who was recipient for the mistake. And it creates a fascinating study. You know, often in professional settings, there are people who are legally advised, I guess by lawyers and so on, not to apologize. Because in the belief, it's a fascinating study, this, in the belief that if you don't apologize, it might avoid lawsuits. I'm talking about like in medical professionalism or something like that, right? Because I guess apologizing is like owning up, so then owning up gives fuel for the person to say, ah, so it was your mistake, it's your fault, so then I'm going to pursue this legally and we'll create a lawsuit, right? I suppose particularly America, because like America, everyone's always suing everyone all the time, right? But interestingly enough, they did a research study on this, right? And they saw that when professionals admit their mistakes and apologize appropriately, there's a lower likelihood of litigation than when a defensive or avoidant position is taken towards the wrong party. It's fascinating. Because that vindictiveness, right, that people have to go and sue people and to begin a process of litigation is very often nothing to do with money. It's got to do with like the chutzpah. You didn't want to even own up to your mistake. You made the mistake and you didn't even want to own up to it. So you don't want to own up to it? I'm going to go and ruin you. I'm going to get you. So apologizing actually reduces the amount of litigation. So now we're not talking about, in our lives we're not talking about litigation, but it's true too. In other words, the relationship between the person making the mistake and the person to whom the mistake was made. And often when we make mistakes, it affects other people, bottom line is. And we actually deepen those relationships by apologizing, not weakening them. And this is really the key issue of apology, because often what happens is we view apology as a weakness when in fact we know apology is a strength. It's a strength on all levels. A strength, first of all, it begins the process of resilience. It begins the process of me being able to take responsibility and begin the willingness and determination to really do something about it, and it also deepens the relationship, not weakens, it deepens the relationship between the person making the mistake and the person to whom the mistake was made, which is quite powerful. And once that is done, then we go to the third thing, right? And the third thing is the commitment to long-term change and post-failure growth, right? Or post-traumatic growth. So, okay, we made a mistake. We've hurt someone else. We've taken responsibility for it. We have apologized for it. Now what do, right? So now begins our own process. We actually have to do something about it. So what do? So as Dr. Pelkowitz says in number 3, he says, first thing we have to realize, we have to move away from being perfect. So like the same thing Brené Brown said. We have to move away from perfectionism. And remember that we are not perfect people. No one is perfect. No one can be perfect, and mistakes will be made. And therefore, when mistakes happen, we have to view them as an opportunity and as something what we're going to do. So what do? We have to begin a process like tshuva, same sort of thing. What do with tshuva? We have to learn from that mistake. But how do we learn from that mistake? And he says something very powerful. Learning from a mistake requires humility, right? And often that humility is not just working it out within ourselves, right? But it's humility of increasing our wisdom by learning from others, including others that are less competent than ourselves. Right? Because often mistakes we make, when we were sure about a choice that we make and we end up making a mistake, has to do with the fact that we're not connected to what's going on outside us, right? So you know that there's a famous thing that Talmud says that it was one of the great sages that said that I learned a lot during my life. He said, I learned a lot from my teachers, more from my friends, and from my students the most. There we are, you see? Right? You learn the most from your students. Why? Because that's where it's really happening. In other words, you can have an idea, you can have a concept, but the concept can be completely hypothetical, completely theoretical, with little relevance. How do you know it's relevant? When someone who's in the receiving end asks you a question. When someone who's not so smart that you know, like you are, can challenge you. From their point of view, from their perspective, from the real world outside of my brain. So like in the cases and the research studies they did with doctors and physicians growing from their mistakes, responsibility was a big part of it. This is all scientifically documented. Taking responsibility, apologizing was a big one. And then learning, including doctors and great physicians, consulting with staff like nurses and undergraduates and things like that. Because those are the people you really learn from. Those are the people who are learning. Those are the people who are exploring. Those are the people who can really ask questions. Those are the people who are still very, very fluid in the fact they're not set in their perspectives, in their ways, right? It's like the Pesach Seder, we know the whole thing resolves around questions, right? Questions are the best way to learn when we have children who notice things that maybe we don't even notice. Notice irregularities, notice inconsistencies, notice things that are strange. And they ask questions. That's how we are motivated to answer and to really go to the depth of the story and the depth of the experience. Right? And that's how we learn from a mistake. So if we view the mistake as an opportunity and a catalyst of growth, it means that we have to go beyond ourselves. You see, if we work out, right? If we just say, I think to myself, okay, let's see, I made a mistake, what is the mistake? But I'm too afraid to ask anyone else. So I work it out and I try to improve next time. I haven't really gone beyond myself. I haven't really grown. I might improve. I mean, next time might be better. I'm not that stupid. I can work out what my mistake was. But I haven't really grown. Nothing's really happened. Maybe next time I'll do it better, but I haven't used it as a catalyst for a quantum leap of growth. But if I explore and I really go into it and I reflect, and that reflection includes, right, confronting my own failings by actually talking to people who are even less than me, less in the sense of less experience, younger, less expertise, whatever the case is, umi talmidai from my students, yotermi kulam, even more than everyone, that's the way we really grow from the mistakes that we make, right? And he quotes a doctor that says the following, a doctor, I don't know how you pronounce this, Kachali or something. He says he found that the physicians who actively engage in the growth process that resulted from painfully confronting the fallout from their mistakes achieved a newfound sense of wisdom that included increased patience with themselves and others, a healthy sense of recognition of their own limitations, which is a very important part of growth, and the ability to relate to patients with high levels of compassion and confidence. As they came to forgive themselves and seek forgiveness from the patients who they inadvertently harmed, the doctors in turn became more forgiving of family members, peers, and employees. In other words, like this. Learning from a mistake doesn't only... This is another level to this, which is amazing. Learning from a mistake shouldn't only mean that I learn from the mistake in that particular area of my failing, right? Learning from any mistake or bouncing back from any mistake that we make needs to mean that I become a better person all around. Right? In other words, learning from a mistake doesn't only mean learning the process of learning from a mistake. The process of growing from a failing. The process itself, if done correctly, makes me a better person. I move away from the belief that I'm perfect. I move away from the arrogance that I can work everything out myself. I move away from not taking responsibilities. I take responsibility. I go into a mode of seeking forgiveness, understanding my limitations, being more patient to listen to others, to learn from others, to gain wisdom from others. So what they found is that when a person does that properly, it's spilled over to so many other areas of life. That the person didn't only become a better doctor, but became a better person. And that's an amazing thing. That should be true in every time that we may make a mistake. If we confront it properly, right? And we learn about the nuances of life. We learn that, you know, I thought everything was black and white, and it's not, and so on and so forth. Right? That becomes not just a better expert in that field, but a better person. And then I want to go back now to what I started with, the concept of Teshuvah, because what that means is as follows. You see, if I bounce back from a mistake, right? But I only do it just enough to fix that mistake, then I'm fixing the future, I haven't fixed the past. Okay, so I made a mistake, I won't make it again, fine. But if I broaden it out, right? And my process in learning from a mistake is not just a process of fixing that mistake, but it's a whole process of personal growth. As I said before, we learn to confront, we learn to forgive, we learn to ask forgiveness, we learn not to take responsibility, all of these things. We learn how to gain wisdom, we learn how to deepen our wisdom by asking others and exploring and so on and so forth. And as a result, I become a better person. What that means is that the mistake becomes part of the journey of growth. And therefore the mistake wasn't just a mistake. The mistake was part of the growth process. And that's the depth of what we mean, that when we really bounce back from a mistake, or we apply the concept of tshuva, right? That tshuva even fixes the past. What does it mean fixes the past? The many mistakes that we make that are unfixable, right? We can't undo what we've done a lot of times. But we can make the mistake a catalyst for much deeper and greater growth. And when we do, in hindsight, the mistake becomes a positive thing. It doesn't stop being a painful thing necessarily. It was a time of pain. But we turn it into, we transform it into a negative thing, from a negative thing into a positive thing. It becomes something that has actually helped us become a better human being. So the mistake, the failing, ended up being a catalyst for another step of growth, right? Going back to that Talmud that I've shared with you many times, I think even last week, Rabbi Akiva laughed when he saw the destruction of the temple, because he said destruction can be a part of growth. It's painful, that's why the others cried, and he cried too. But nevertheless, he also laughed, because pain and failing can actually be a part of growth. In all areas of resilience. Because you give the pain meaning, and if resilience is in the context of our own failings, our own mistakes, the giving the meaning to the mistake means that we use the mistake to become a much better human being. And that's, in other words, that's, and the outcome is radically different than before. It's not just fixing this mistake. It's not just improving the way I do the operation or the way I teach or the way I do this, right? It's a much more radical difference, a much more radical growth. And therefore, the mistake became a brick in that building of growth, which is very, very powerful. Just to end off with a couple of other comments about failure. It's in the book, by the way. This is an article I wrote, which is in this booklet as well. But going back, just to summarize, sort of, if our life is value based, then and we understand the definition of success, also becomes much easier to deal with failure, because success means I'm continuously growing, and if failure is a part of the growth, then it's like the failure became worth it almost, right? Also, again, failure doesn't define us. Second thing is that it's a learning opportunity. The other thing I wanted to point out, it's a very, very important thing to understand with regard to failure and the ability to bounce back from failure, is to always remember that failure never negates our previous successes, right? Because whatever good we do in this world, every part of growth that we experience in this world is always there. It's always eternal. I think I've given you an analogy in the past, that if you go into a destination and there's 10 blocks of walk to get there, and you walk 6 blocks and then you fall and hurt your leg and you can't go further, you still walk the 6 blocks. You just have to wait now until your leg gets better so you can continue on, right? It doesn't negate the previous progress. It's a very, very important thing to understand. The good that we do, because often people define themselves by the last experience that they had. Teachers do that, right? They define themselves by the last lesson that they had. If it was a good lesson, they're a good teacher. If it was a bad lesson, they're a bad teacher. Which is a very big mistake, that, because we're not our last experience. We're a total of lots of things. And even though we might have messed up yesterday, but the weeks before we did amazing things, and that's fine. And even the mistake that we made, we can now work through in the ways that we described before. But that's a really important thing. And then, just to summarize again, we need to take failure and make it a catalyst for real growth. And then not just does it fix the future, but even fixes the past and becomes a part of the growth journey. So that's just a little bit about resilience from the area of failure. So next week we'll have one more lesson, one more class, discussion on resilience, and then take a little break. Have a wonderful day.